information goes. There was a few things I wanted to mention. So I was looking for articles over the last week that were sort of published and came to light. I haven't had a chance to read these, but I just figured I'd throw them out there. I'm not endorsing or criticizing or anything with these journal articles. They've just come out over the past week, so I figured I would just throw it out there. The Overshoot Ice Age Theory, that's the first one, and that was a study published in Science on December 21st, and that was by researchers at UC Riverside, and they identified a missing feedback in Earth's carbon cycle. So what they're saying is the team found that as the planet warms, increased nutrient-rich runoff fuels massive plankton blooms. Under low oxygen conditions, these blooms bury carbon so effectively that they can trigger a cooling rebound that overshoots and potentially plunges the planet into an ice age. So what they're implying is while this won't stop modern warming in the short term, it suggests that Earth's natural thermostat is much more volatile than previously thought. So that's the first publication. That's just a short synopsis. I haven't actually had a chance to read it. The next one is atmospheric river shifting towards the poles. And this is some new research from UC Santa Barbara, and that came out on the 27th. And this basically, what the research suggests is that it's confirmed that atmospheric rivers, like the one that we see hitting California, they've shifted about 6 to 10 degrees poleward in both hemispheres over the last 40 years. And the impact is that the shift fundamentally is altering where extreme precipitation falls. And it also explains why regions like the Yukon are seeing more intense moisture-driven events, despite the extreme cold, which tends to be drier, while mid-latitude regions are facing more droughts, punctuated by rare massive floods. Let me cycle it. And these are just the ones that came out there. And the next one, there's only three more. Clouds, not pollution, is driving the heat imbalance. And this is a study in Science Advances, and that's as of December 21st. And this came out of the University of Miami, and it revealed that Earth's growing heat imbalance, so this is the difference between energy absorbed and emitted, is driven primarily by changes in clouds rather than air pollution, so aerosols. And the finding that they had in this study was that satellite data showed the cleaner air in the Northern Hemisphere has reduced the number of particles that help reflect sunlight, so this allows more solar energy to reach the surface, accelerating ocean warming. The next one was the launch of Canada's Rapid Attribution System. So on December, this is a little older, but I said let me throw this one in anyway. Environment and Climate Change Canada, they renamed it a few years ago, I don't know why, but they did. They launched a new system to determine in near real time how much climate change influenced a specific weather event. And the early results of this is that of 42 extreme precipitation events analyzed, 39 were found to be significantly more likely due to human-caused warming. And the system is now being used to analyze the current Yukon deep freeze. I'm going to look a little bit more into this because this is a bit of a this one has me interested. I'm trying to figure out how exactly they're coming to this mathematically, what exactly this rapid attribution system entails. So I'm going to look more into it, and I'll have some answers for you hopefully next week. Let me drop it. And the last one, and this actually came out on Christmas Day. It's an interesting day to release a published finding. Deep ocean hotspots and storm intensity. So this research was published on December 25th, and it highlights the expansion of subsurface ocean hotspots near the Philippines and the Caribbean. And it was actually published by the WMO through their they've got a report that they publish. So, and the WMO is a World Meteorological Organization. There's a bunch of named scientists in the report. And what it basically says is that these deep sea reservoirs of heat allow hurricanes and typhoons to maintain Category 5 strength, even as they move into areas where surface waters might typically be cooler, providing a second wind for storms that would historically have weakened. So what the suggestion, so what the idea here is that, you know, hurricanes, they can chew up the upper layers of the water and mix them through. But we're discovering now that they're typically the ocean, any body of water gets cooler as you go deeper down, right? Not infinitely cooler, of course, but if it's really, really hot, the hottest water is near the surface and you go deeper down, it gets cooler. But what they're seeing is in some cases, in particular with shallower waters that are still deep, they're 30, 40, 50 meters deep or more, 100 meters, that there's enough heat energy through the entire water column, right to the bottom of the column, that even if you disrupt the surface of the ocean there, there's enough subsurface heat that when that gets upwelled, it'll still fuel the storm. So that's basically what this one's looking at. I read a little bit more on that one in particular. Okay, let me drop it. That's it for the interesting articles that have come out this week, with the exception of the Environment Canada article that came out on December 11th that I forgot to mention, but I did now. I don't know if we have time or not, but if Ken, I don't know if you're interested or not. I did have a little bit of a section that I put together here for determining winter precipitation and what meteorologists look at, to figure out what's going to, what's going to fall from the sky. Is it going to be snow? Is it going to be rain, freezing rain, ice pelts, et cetera? I don't know if we have time for that or not. I'll send it over to you, Ken. Do you want me to discuss that? VA3VWX over to Net Control.
That is VA3KX. Yeah, sure, Tom, if you feel like it, go ahead.
All right, and this is the last part. I won't bore. I know not everybody loves the weather, so I'm not going to bore everybody with it. So when meteorologists, they basically look at, they want to know what's going to happen with a storm. And by the way, mixed winter precipitation, in particular freezing rain and ice pelts, are some of the most difficult types of weather, at least precipitation, to forecast. There's a very fine line between ice pellets and freezing rain and rain. And in particular, freezing rain out of everything is among the hardest type of weather to predict, just because there's a lot of variables and the minuscule changes can result in big differences, in particular rain versus ice pellets. And rain is okay, and ice pellets, they're not as bad as freezing rain. So there's a very narrow window for freezing rain. Okay, so what meteorologists will look at is they'll analyze the vertical profile of the atmosphere, and you can think about it as a 3D slice of air from the clouds to the ground, and this determines whether a snowflake remains a snowflake, or it's going to melt into rain, or turns into a glaze of ice. And the first thing we look at is the melting layer and the warm nose. So the most critical winter feature in weather forecasting is the melting layer, and in a perfect snow scenario, the entire atmosphere is below the freezing mark. But with many storms, you have something called overrunning, and this is where warm air, moist air, is basically pushed up and over a cold air mass at the surface. So that's what overrunning is. And the warm nose, that's a layer of air above freezing, wedged between the two sub-freezing layers. So there'll be cold air above it and cold air below it. So you get this warm nose, which is this like river of warm air that's above freezing. And the warm nose is defined a few different ways. The first way is a shallow. So if it's a shallow warm nose, that means that it's typically between the freezing mark and 1 degree Celsius. And in this case, depth is also important too, right? So you're looking at the depth of it, but the temperature is also very important. So a shallow warm nose that has a low temperature, 0 to 1 degree Celsius, that might only partially melt and refreeze snow, and that'll turn it into sleet or ice pellets once it drops into the colder air near the surface and it refreezes. And of course, then if the warm nose is deep or warm, or both, let's say warmer than 3 degrees Celsius, the snowflakes will typically melt completely into a raindrop. And then that could either fall as freezing rain, or if the cold dome or the cold air at the surface is cooler, it can refreeze and fall to the ground as sleet, but it would be more akin to like a little tiny hailstone, like pea-sized hail. But it would still technically be sleet, not hail. Let me drop it. So, as you can imagine, because we're looking at both temperature and depth, so depth of the warm air, depth of the melt layer, So how long precipitation is falling through it, which is critically important, and what the temperature of it is. There's a very, very narrow, I'm not going to get into all the math, but we can look at vertical profiles of the atmosphere, and there are different algorithms that can be used to determine precipitation type, and they basically factor all this in, and they'll give a best guess for type of precipitation, and it appears as a chart. So if you're looking at SKU-T with software, you can set it into a winter setting mode, and it'll basically give you a best guess of, you know, is it going to be ice pellets, freezing rain, or a mix of both, depending on what's going on. But it's a very fine line for freezing rain, and of course, freezing rain occurs when you have water that makes it into a cold layer near the ground. As liquid, it hits trees, poles, whatever, and it hits in liquid form, and then it freezes shortly after. Bright banding. So this is an interesting phenomenon on a radar. The melting layer will sometimes appear as a high reflectivity signature, and meteorologists call this bright banding. It looks like almost like a rainbow. And what it basically is it looks like a feather sometimes, and you get a high area of reflectivity. If anybody, I guess most people wouldn't have seen this, but if there's chafe or chaff, you know, those aluminum or metal strips that are deployed to calibrate radars and other things, that's what it sort of looks like. Like, it's a very intense return signature, and it looks like a feather. It's basically a band of high reflectivities. And what this is basically snowflakes begin to melt. They'll develop a thin film of liquid water on their jagged edges. And because water is about 10 times more reflective to radar waves than ice, and because a wet snowflake has a much larger surface area than a compact raindrop, the radar perceives them as intense raindrops, right, as really big raindrops. So on radar, that appears as a ring or a bright band of colors that suggests heavy rain, when in reality, it's just moderately falling snow just halfway through the melting process. But it's important because meteorologists can look at this and say, oh, we have bright banding, so there's a melt zone here. The other thing that they use is the correlation coefficient, CC. So in modern dual polarization radars, the correlation coefficient measures how similar the shapes of falling particles are. This is why we can use it to figure out, so snow and rain, they have a high CC. It's about 0.97. When it's all snow or all rain, the particles are uniform, right? If there's a melting layer, you'll have a CC of 0.8 to 0.95, and that's within a bright band where you have sort of this junk mix of dry snow, wet snow, and raindrops, and the lack of uniformity causes the CC values to plummet, so they get really messy. And it's also why we can use the CC value to say, hey, there's particles that the radar is detecting that are not water. Right, they're not cloud particles. This is when a tornado hits a farm or a house or whatever. You get pieces of wood, debris, leaves, things like that in the air. That shows up on the correlation coefficient as an irregular return, and we know through experience what the return signature should be, and we can say, oh, this is debris, or this is these are insects. So the correlation coefficient can do that. Let me drop it. So with the correlation coefficient, you can also basically, the radars will scan different altitudes, right? They'll do one scan at, let's say, 0.2 degrees or 0.5 degrees, and they'll tilt up, right, upwards of about 4 degrees. And looking at the different scans progressively, obviously as the beam gets further from the Earth, it gets higher up, and this because of the curvature of the Earth, the fall-off becomes quicker, right? But you can still correlate the beam height above the ground, and using the CC you can figure out roughly what a column of air or column of precipitation is doing within a certain region. You can sort of watch these melt zones propagate and things change. The other thing meteorologists look at is something called the dendritic snow growth region, the DSGR, and this is higher up in the clouds, and this is basically, typically this is somewhere around 850 millibars, that's 1.5 kilometers or higher, and that's the layer where temperatures are typically between about minus 12 and minus 18 degrees Celsius, so minus 18 Celsius is zero Fahrenheit, and that's sort of the sweet spot. And that's where water vapor transitions most efficiently into the classic six-sided bushy snowflakes, those big dendrites that we get. And if they're strong upwards motion, so lift, within this layer, you can get a high ratio of liquid to snow ratio, right? So the snow tends to be fluffy and that'll pile up very quickly. Convective snows, like lake effect snows, ocean effect snows, those tend to have a high, the water, the liquid to snow ratio is very, very high. Whereas heavy wet